It being 1 o'clock, the Election, Finance, and Government Operations Committee is called to order. Does anyone have any questions in regards to last minutes?
I move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Altidorf has moved the minutes. Is there any question? Chair Freiberg.
Thank you. I just glanced at this, and it says HF 3881. It says Representative Vernig presented HF 3881 on an informational basis. I don't recall that being the case.
Roughly, yeah. Thank you, Chair. So I was just conferring with the CLAs, and I think I had two questions about, I think we do need to make that edit that the bills were not heard on an informational basis, that there was actually hearing. And then I think the second question was whether we have to also say that the bills were officially laid over, but I'm understanding that we may not need that anymore, and so we might just have to,
yeah,
go back.
My thought then is to not take these minutes up and take time from the committee, and we'll try to address that offline, and then on Wednesday, hopefully, there'll be an order to move forward. And would, so we'll go to our first bill. Is Representative Witte? Oh, there he is. Representative Davis.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move before the committee House File 2185. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And move before the committee with a recommendation.
Yeah, recommendation to move to the general registry. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And to the author of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Chair Quam. Today, I bring forward a bill that was brought to me by one of my constituents, and it's the display of certain flags and the limitations of them. Under current law, there is regulations, restrictive covenant, and local ordinance, contract, rental agreements, or regulation, or homeowner association document that limits the rights of residential property owners or tenants to display the United States flag and the flag of state of Minnesota to be void and unenforceable. What this bill does is adds the National League of Families, the POW missing in action flag, the flag of any branch of the United States Armed Forces, or a Blue Star service flag or a Gold Star service flag to the list of those flags that would apply.
Thank you to the author. Does anyone have questions? Or I did see an amendment in the packet. I didn't know if that was being offered or not. There's a testifier. Okay. So, sorry about that. Again, is there anyone offering an amendment? Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can if you'd like. I don't know if there are testifiers on the bill, if we're going to them or going, could you just let me know how you'd like the discussion on this bill to go between public testimony, amendments, member discussion, that sort of thing?
The information I had is if the amendment was being offered, there was somebody that wished to testify to that.
Okay.
So if someone has questions to the bill beforehand, before offering the amendment.
Okay, I can offer the amendment if that's your wish.
It's up to you, Chair Freiberg.
No, if this is the appropriate time, I will offer the DE1 amendment.
Okay, and the DE1 amendment been offered. Did you want to speak to Chair Freiberg.
Sure. So thank you, Representative Witte, for bringing this forward. Thank you for chatting with me over the weekend. I appreciate it. I do like what you're trying to do here. I think this makes a change for several very important groups whose service I have tremendous respect for. The concern I have is that there are many other groups who we might want to also afford the ability to have a flag flown. You know, there could be, you know, I know there might be people who would want to put up a flag honoring first responders or offering police, you know, honoring police. You know, there's a variety of groups out there. And it does seem, you know, I think we passed this. I know there was a bill dealing with this provision in the previous session. I forget if it was to add the Minnesota flag to it or exactly how it works, but I could just see a situation where every year we're coming back because there's another group that we're thinking about. So this amendment just, you know, makes it so that there's no First Amendment problems, no group is getting favored treatment. It just says that an owner or tenant of a residential property, if there's an HOA, has to be allowed to display any flag that's out there. But it does have an exception in there also, which is prohibiting flags that might incite violence or unlawful activity. I spoke to you about this. It sounded like you might be open to it. So Representative Witte, I'd be just interested in your thoughts on it.
Yeah. To the author.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Quam. Thank you, Chair Freiberg, for the discussion. You know, as we talked about it, I think one of the things that I looked at was supporting our first responders or our police. And right now, I think, as, you know, just supporting our military families, I think, is the right approach, because as we were talking, there could be hostility one way or another. So I was trying to keep it pretty simple right now as we move forward. I think it's one that, as you know, I realize on a Blue Star family as someone that's actively in a conflict or anything right now serving. And quite ironically, this bill I think I offered 2 years ago. My daughter's dating someone who just serves for the Iowa National Guard. They were over in Syria when the conflict happened. And we picked them up, or my daughter picked them up on Saturday to bring them home. And there's families like that that obviously would want to be displaying the flag, and we don't want to take that opportunity away, especially when they're fighting for our freedoms over there. And Gold Star families, as we, you know, recently have heard, you know, we don't want these conflicts to now come back here and prohibit it. So that's why I kept it pretty narrow and off of what my constituent had asked.
Thank you. We do have a testifier, Mr. Hines. Please state your name and if you have an affiliation, and then your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Patrick Hines with Messerly Kramer. I represent the Community Associations Institute Minnesota chapter. CAI is an organization that represents the interests of homeowner associations. We have members who are residents, board members, property managers, attorneys, contractors, and anyone who deals regularly with homeowner associations. CAI has a longstanding policy regarding the regulation of flags or any other architectural controls in a homeowner association. While there is a need to balance the speech rights of residents, we also believe that HOAs, through their elected board members, are best equipped to regulate the day-to-day operations of their communities, which would include regulating flags, signs, or even inflatables. So the current law in Minnesota, it's been this way for quite some time, makes an exception for the United States flag as well as the flag of the state of Minnesota. The underlying bill by Representative Witte makes a very modest expansion of the exception. We would oppose the elimination of the ability of any homeowner association to regulate flags in Minnesota.
Chair Freitag, or Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair Quam. It's been a while since I've been called that, so I appreciate that. I guess my question is for Mr. Hines. Like, Do you have thoughts about the underlying bill? I mean, it seems like the arguments you presented would apply equally, you know, in either whether it's the underlying bill, whether it's the delete everything amendment, it seems like the arguments you present would kind of counsel against either approach.
Chair Freiberg, I thought he said, has already specified in his testimony that the small addition of the flags listed in the underlying bill, they didn't have an issue. The issue was when you, on 1.7 of the DE, in place the word the, you have any flag. Is that correct, Mr.?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freiberg. Yes, that's correct. The statute that made the exception for the U.S. and Minnesota flags was passed some time ago. I don't remember exactly when. And so that's the current policy of the state of Minnesota, and Representative Witte's bill is a pretty modest expansion of that. So if the legislature wishes to do that, I don't think we have objection, but allowing or prohibiting any regulation of flags at a homeowner association by their elected members, we would oppose.
Thank you. Any further question? Chair Freiberg. We're just discussing the amendment. Any other questions on the DE amendment? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just as we're talking about this, you know, the fact that we had to pass a law to allow people to fly the flag, the U.S. and Minnesota flag, or in this case, a veterans flag, but I would say much broader. To me, again, sort of we talked about what private governance means and a bunch of folks who are not elected and not accountable making these decisions. I mean, I support this amendment. I support the underlying idea, too. But again, I think I hate inflatables, I'll say, like, and they're on my block. But I also don't think that it's my, like, I don't have a homeowner association. I don't think that a private group of self-appointed folks without the same kind of transparency and laws that our local governments have should be deciding whether that terrible dragon, flying dragon inflatable, or the, you know, whether it's holidays or whatever. So I support this amendment and think that we should prevent private governance from telling people what to do on their own yards.
Representative Coulter. I'll
come back. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I just will say on this amendment, I hadn't sort of considered this until just now, but my concern is, I mean, I am fine voting for the bill, to be clear, but my concern is that if we don't adopt this amendment, I think just to emphasize what Representative Freiberg said, we're going to be coming back sort of year after year, carving in more exceptions. And I also fear that in the future, if that's the approach we take, that in the future, a worthy exception may not move forward, may get voted down strictly out of political considerations. And I don't think we should be playing politics with people's First Amendment rights that way. So thank you.
To the testifier, and then if the author had a statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify one statement that the restrictions we're talking about would be enacted by an elected board. All of the board members of an association are residents and unit owners, and the unit owners elect those board members. And it's up to the unit owners whether the board members adopt rules about restricting a flag or restricting anything else. So I do just want to clarify that the board members themselves are elected by their neighbors, and they are the ones who would decide. So we feel that that is appropriate because that's the closest level of regulation there is, a group of neighbors deciding we want this or we want that collectively.
And to the author, to the two questions.
Yeah, I appreciate that, the conversation. It's under the homeowners association, but it could also be a local city that does an ordinance or a contracted deed who buys the house saying that you can't do that. So there's a lot of different things. And the reason I'm trying to keep this very narrow is it is one that I think we all agree for our country and our support in our military. We see that most of the time our most bipartisan, strongest support bills on the floor are for our veterans. And to have that opportunity to display the flag and not have to fight for it. If they would have to fight for it, if it's in law, they would be responsible to pay for the legal fees. The other part is Florida, Illinois, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee currently have this on the books. And Minnesota, Nevada, Ohio, and Washington are the state flag one. So this would just add a smaller, narrow one, one that we've shown bipartisan support throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some issue with the amendment. I think, you know, my problem, I would argue is if currently the way this is written, it would have us come back and re-debate just specifically this amendment, because the second part of this amendment under subdivision 2 states that it's tailored to protect health or safety or to prevent the incitement of violence and unlawful activity. That's a very broad statement. So if I have a Trump's flag or, you know, a flag that somebody may not like, that could, in their mind, incite violence. And so we could sit here and play that game all day. I think there's, you know, a little bit too much broad, you know, vague terminology in this amendment.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a question for Mr. Hines, because you talked about sort of elections. Do you know if HOAs, does Chapter 13 data practices and open meeting laws apply to HOAs?
Justifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act does not apply to HOAs, but Chapter 515B, which is the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act, which governs HOA activities, does have multiple requirements relating to the election of members, making meetings and other documents available to members. So while the Data Practices Act doesn't apply, the MCIOWA 515B does have requirements that those boards must meet.
Representative Green?
Thank you. As it relates to the First Amendment, which, right, we only applies when it's government engagement. Does that apply to HOAs?
Justifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman, I would say, as you noted, it, as a private entity, the First Amendment does not apply to the HOA, but to the government.
Thank you.
Did you have a
follow-up? I just wanted, that's exactly.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. That's exactly my point. I don't think we should have private entities without data disclosure laws and without people having their First Amendment rights making these decisions. That's exactly the difference between local government and these HOAs. And so, again, I appreciate this bill, Representative Witte. I think the reason this amendment is actually a good one is it doesn't, again, coming back to what Representative Coulter said, sort of coming back and saying, you know, the state and the U.S. flag are okay, veterans' flags are okay, but others aren't, is to me seems like something we should not give to a private set of actors that are not governed by the First Amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm a little bit confused because the bill isn't granting any authority to HOAs. It's actually restricting their authority to prevent the patriotic military and the other ones listed in this bill. So whether the amendment was on or not, you know, I don't think that is a relevant statement. Any other? Representative Davis.
Just real quickly, kind of piggybacking off of what Representative Roach already said, this amendment is not ready because or to prevent the incitement of violence or unlawful activity. And again, I'll just reiterate, you're potentially opening up a huge can of worms on who's going to decide what incites violence and what doesn't. And so I would highly recommend a no vote on this amendment. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment my two cents on this, I think that first of all, I agree with Representative Greenman that this seems very unfortunate that we have to pass laws to allow people who own their private property to be able to display a flag. But that is the nature of these HOAs, as last week we had bills that address that, or a bill, because they have grown too authoritative and we're infringing on people's public property. And although my wife prohibits me from flying any inflatables anytime on our yard, it is for the children, first of all, not us adults. But I think that your amendment, Representative Freiberg, is not, I would disagree with it because something that Representative Coulter said, he said we shouldn't always necessarily do carve-outs or something to that, if I'm paraphrasing, carve-outs. Folks, here at the Capitol for 100 years or so, everything's been a carve-out. Are you kidding? Have you looked at the sugar beet industry? I mean, I love sugar beets, of course, but there's been carve-out after carve-out after carve-out. That's all we do here at the state capitol for the most part. So carve-outs are a custom and usage of this whole state since its inception, as far as politically speaking. So therefore, I throw my support to the bill and think it's necessary that we do a carve-out to ensure that the HOAs who have gone too authoritative to deny such a very important flag. And for that reason, I will support your bill, Reverend Witte, and I think that your bill, although has some great merit, there are some portions in it that I think are troubled and problematic, and therefore, unfortunately, you'll be sad to hear. I cannot vote for your amendment, Representative Freiberg.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to speak on behalf of the DE and say I actually support it because it would cut out work for us. I disagree with comments that, you know, this would bring work back. I mean, right now, it's the HOAs that are deciding this, right? And as Mr. Hines has mentioned, these are folks, you know, who know their community and, you know, would get to decide, like, what it means to incite violence or what is unlawful. And I hope that, you know, we can let those people decide what that means. It doesn't mean that folks would have to come back to the legislature, right? This is a good amendment that would mean, you know, we don't need folks to come back and ask for, you know, more flags, right? Like, if we have, like, Space Force right now, and, like, do we need to specify that, like, you know, you can fly a flag celebrating, you know, your family member in the U.S. Space Force, right? And so I just wanted to clarify that, right, that this bill doesn't create more work for the legislature. It, you know, would give that power back to the HOAs to decide what that means. Thanks.
Does the author want to clarify? Okay. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just say one more thing. I mean, your amendment, it literally disputes itself because you allow it to display any flag, but then you limit any flag based off of what someone deems as incitement. So it's literally a contradictory amendment. It's like a nothing burger, in my opinion, that is just here to slow us down. So I'm against this amendment.
Any statement, Chair Freiberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just point out the provision about the exception being narrowly tailored to protect public health or safety is already an existing law, so that exemption is already there. It does add the provision about the preventing the incitement of violence or unlawful activity. If there were an attempt to argue that certainly by a local government, but also more than likely by an HOA, that a political flag of some sort, whether it's for one side or the other, is something that is dealing with incitement of violence or unlawful activity, I think that would be both pretty clearly a problem with the First Amendment, but then also, you know, there's other laws that say that require the placement of what's called non-commercial signs and flags out there. So I don't know. I just don't think that argument is supported, and I'd encourage members to support the amendment.
All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
It doesn't pass. Is there, to the underlying bill, any more comments? Okay. Then Representative Davis, you wish to?
I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2185 to the General Registry, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill moves on. Thank you to the author. And if Representative Gordon.
Thank you, committee members.
Wanted to go to the testifiers table.
Mr. Chair.
Well, I guess you can sort of introduce yourself if you wanted, but if you could move your bill.
Okay. I would like to move HF 3719, or excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong one there. I'd like to move HF 1849 before the committee to be re-referred to the Rules Committee.
Okay, and proceed. Did you have an author's amendment?
I do. Let me just kind of touch on the bill itself here first, but HF 1849 creates an opportunity for a constitutional amendment to limit the offices of governor and lieutenant governor to 2 4-year terms. The proposed constitutional amendment would be submitted to the voters, and the language of the ballot question is included in the text of the bill. But before we get to that, like you mentioned, I do have the A2 author's amendment that I'd like to move before the committee.
Is there anyone wishing to have discussion? The A2 is fairly technical, so seeing no discussion. And you've moved and stated, so all in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment passes.
All right, thank you. I've kind of already covered the text of what the bill does. The amendment basically just made some changes to the effective dates of when the terms would start being counted towards the term limits. And I'm happy to answer any questions. If
there is an A3 amendment, did someone wish to move the A3? Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the amendment, I'm not going to move it. We did have that prepared because I think it raises some important issues, but there is a potential issue with Joint Rule 2.01, just referring to extra. You're nodding, so I assume you know that. But, when we get to discussion on the bill, we'll probably raise some of the points raised by the amendment, but we will not be offering it at this time.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Any questions to the bill? Would the author have any additional? Oh, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate the work that you've been doing on this. Representative Gordon, I know you've been working on it for a while. It'd just be helpful to hear from you about, as a policy matter, and especially thinking about this, this applies to the Office of the Governor, but why you think that now is the time to do this bill.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman, thank you for that question. I think that now is a great time because there's not an incumbent on the ballot. You know, the original language that we had here was kind of taking into consideration that if Governor Walz wanted to run for a third term, we didn't want to make this an issue about him, and we didn't want to make it a partisan issue. We want to make it on the principle of that we should have term limits on those offices. And so, I think we changed the language with that amendment to start counting the terms in 2026. Since he's no longer on the ballot, we don't have an incumbent on the ballot. And it makes this kind of the opportune time to move forward with this. So does that answer your question?
Representative Greenman, good.
Thank you. Yeah, and I just appreciate, I think when we talk about the executive in Minnesota and nationally, like two terms seems to be the coalescing of where the public is at. We passed a constitutional amendment years and years ago at the federal level, and I don't think Minnesota's ever had a governor longer than two terms, and so it feels like this feels like a prudent way to respond to both public opinion and I think what people think about the length of an executive, both at the federal and state level. So thank you for this bill.
Thank you. Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions for the bill author. I guess Representative Greenman already sort of answered this, but how many Minnesota governors have been elected to three terms?
Well, for the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been none. There's been three that have ran for it. Rudy Perpich, who actually served longer than two terms. I'm not sure exactly how much longer. I know he appointed, forget the other governor that he appointed to the Senate, I think, something like that, and might have cost him an election after the fact. But and then Pawlenty, I believe, ran shortly for a third term, and then Governor Walz now. So,
Chair Freiberg.
Well, I guess the reason I ask is just the fact that they have not, nobody has successfully run for a third term suggests that there's not a huge need for this bill in my mind. You know, there is this stopgap if somebody is running past the point where the voters think they shouldn't, then, you know, as in the case of Governor Perpich, they could very well lose the election. I guess my second question is, you know, the way this bill is worded, it applies only to the governor and lieutenant governor. I guess why is it limited in that fashion? Why shouldn't it also apply to legislators?
The author.
Yeah, and I, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Freiberg. Thank you for the question. Yeah, I think it is a, it is certainly. I'm open if you want to talk about term limits for the legislature. I'm open to that discussion. But this bill is a start. We got to start somewhere. And we wanted to keep it very simple and basic and to the point. So,
further question?
No, I guess maybe I'll make a comment. I might make a closing comment as well, but I did want to ask those questions. I mean, I, at this point, am not supportive of this amendment. I do think we have an automatic mechanism in place to prevent governors or other elected, any elected official for that matter, that might be viewed as overstaying their welcome, and that's called an election. So I don't see the need for this and will not be supporting it.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Gordon actually clarified what I was going to make because Representative Greenman mentioned this. But just to clarify that this proposed language would not necessarily affect how much time someone would serve as governor. I'm assuming if someone were to be lieutenant governor and then succeeded the office of governor because of vacancy in that office, you know, in theory, they could serve, you know, 3 years and 364 days of a previous governor's term, and then afterward could be elected twice if they were to run themselves. So just based on a comment that Representative Greenman made that I wanted to clarify that this does not regulate the amount of time that someone can serve as governor.
I think math dictates that it definitely would. It'd be less than 12 years. So that is a limitation of time. So the variability would be between 8 years and a few days less than 12. So that's distinctive limits. Any other members have comments? Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I understand, you know, there's a difference between executive power and legislative power, so you know there aren't legislative term limits in this bill, but also curious, you know, why maybe there are not term limits for the Secretary of State or you know other executive officers.
To the author,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee, for the question. And if you want to talk term limits for other positions, I'm more than willing to do that. I think that those are probably popular positions to take and. I'm certainly willing to talk further with you about that. But like I said, we wanted to start somewhere, and this was, I think, the easiest place to start. So,
I'm not seeing any other comments. My observations have been that even good people, after a while, the electorate, they want to, a change, something different. That's just sort of off the cuff. I noticed that that's probably true if we've never had a governor go for three terms. The only thing that comes to my mind is that you then ensure that there's a longer amount of time for others when a governor's in a second term to decide to, consider it and check it out and go. And they're not being refrained from that activity by the governor being in their party. But that's just sort of, you know, when the discussion came up. And I talked long enough to Representative Roach. You've got a question.
Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I agree with some of the sentiment on the other side as far as, you know, why limit it to just the executive branch. What I appreciate about it is it's a more specific bill, but as we move this along and it gets to the general registry, we can definitely bring amendments to the floor and have that debate as a larger body on some of those things. And to remind them that this wouldn't make it law. It just would allow the voters to be able to vote on it. So we just want to give, I think what Representative Gordon is doing is trying to empower the voters of Minnesota to be able to have that decision. So thank you, Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Just a quick comment regarding this. I think that the best thing and the best reason we should do this, in my humble opinion, is that it's the people on it. If you talk to most people, and we all have, they do believe, they being the majority of the people, that term limits are a good thing. That's at least my observation in the last 16 years being here and 20-some years being in politics or politically active, maybe 30 years now. Well, anyway, but I think it gives credence to the people that they believe that we down here are not self-serving and are willing to support any measures that takes away time that we are spent as a public servant. Does that make sense? I think Representative Drazkowski or Senator Drazkowski had a bill many years ago to do term limits, and I supported that as I did support cut in pay and other things. And the people, our constituents, the voters who has lost confidence in us, like that. So this, if anything, should get your support, Representative Freiberg, Chair Freiberg, because it does show to our constituents, both Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and those who don't even give a heck, that this is a good thing, and they believe that you shouldn't be in politics for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years. So therefore, Representative Gordon, thanks for bringing this to us, and let's show the people, our constituents out in Minnesota, that this is good for good governance. Let the other person serve once in a while. So I would support the legislature as well. Would you support an oral amendment today for that?
To the author.
No, and to Representative Roach's point and McDonald, I wouldn't support an oral amendment today. I think that's something that needs to be hashed out further. I think that there's, I would support term limits for the legislature, but that's a very complex issue. It takes a long time to learn the lay of the land here, and I think that there's a variance between even states that do have term limits for the legislature on how they approach that. And I'm not sure what the answer is to that question. And as far as, you know, what the approach would be, and I think that deserves further discussion and much more thought and input. This, I think, is way more simple, and like I said, we got to start somewhere. I don't believe we can add amendments on the House floor, to Representative Roach's point, to a constitutional amendment, can we? I guess maybe that's a question for nonpartisan, but.
Mr. Gehring.
Chair, committee members, so there is a House rule that prohibits a constitutional amendment from itself being offered as an amendment to a bill on the floor, but there's no prohibition in the rule on amending a proposed constitutional amendment on the floor.
Okay. But yeah, no, that's not my intention to really expand this at this point. I think we've got bipartisan authorship on this, and I think it's just a good thing for Republicans and Democrats to kind of move forward with. So I don't anticipate expanding it or have a desire to expand it right now at this point. But I appreciate the sentiment and I appreciate the support of the bill.
Would Chair Freiberg have a closing statement? Okay, thank you. Did the author want a final statement or you could?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Representative Coulter, we call that quam bombed in the caucus there. When the calendar says 12 years, right? So, but no, it would still allow, like I said, Governor Walz, Governor Pawlenty could still seek two more terms. So it's not, but to your point of, you know, does it address the issue of going back, you know, if someone were to take the office, it doesn't, but to Representative's quam point, the calendar does. So, with that, in closing, you know, this is popular policy on both sides of the aisle. I think it's a bill that is a win for both Republicans and Democrats. Like I mentioned, it has bipartisan authorship and support, and I'm confident the people of Minnesota will appreciate our willingness to work together in an effort to seek out their wisdom on the issue of term limits for the governor and lieutenant governor. And like I mentioned earlier, there's no better time than now with no incumbent candidates on the ballot, and I would like to ask for a yes vote. And with that, I'll renew my motion that HF 1849 be re-referred to the Rules Committee.
As amended?
As amended.
And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
And it does move to the Rules Committee. And to your next bill.
Thank you, Chair Quam. I'd like to move that HF 3719 before the committee and to be referred to the General Register.
And continue with introducing your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HF 3719 would direct the Campaign Finance Board to conduct a feasibility study to determine the efficacy of allowing local candidates to utilize the board's reporting software. The bill lays out a manner in which the feasibility study is to be conducted and requires a report back to this committee or whichever committee has jurisdiction over elections at the time that the report is due. And I do have an A1 author's amendment that I can expand on here further if you're obliged to let me do so.
It looks to be just dates being changed. Are there any discussion we want before? Seeing none, did you wish to move author move his amendment?
Yes, so I'll move the author's, the A1 author's amendment before the committee, and basically, like Chair Quam said, it's just moving the dates for the feasibility study to coincide with the 2028 election rather than the 2026 election, and that was language that was added at the request of the Campaign Finance Board to give them time to prepare and do the feasibility study when it works a little bit better for them. So,
and with that, all in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. And your bill has been amended to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm open to discussion and happy to answer any questions. And I believe we do have a testifier.
Oh, I believe the testifier is not going to testify.
Okay, perfect.
Is there anyone else in the audience? Seeing none, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. This is actually an idea that I've been thinking about, and so I appreciate it, but I'm also just curious if there's a fiscal note for the bill or if we know how much this is going to cost.
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee. I think that's a great question. And the original feasibility study, I believe, was only for four jurisdictions and maybe the Campaign Finance Board. I believe we've got Jeff here to maybe answer your question on that. But I'm assuming that that's something that they can probably just absorb, as it's just, you know, really kind of expanding the availability of the software. So at least for the study portion of it, I would guess that that's the case. But I'd be happy to hear from the Campaign Finance Board to see what their thoughts are.
And if you'd introduce yourself and give us your wisdom.
Hi, Mr. Chair, committee members, Jeff Sigurdsson of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. A fiscal note was requested this morning. I do think, at least initially, that the cost related to this would be something that the board could absorb. It's basically stripping down existing application that is available to your level of campaign to the much simpler requirements of Chapter 211A for local candidates. By giving us enough time to do this with internal staff, I think the only other cost that we've identified, at least initially, is that we would probably stand this up, the application on its own server, but we've moved to the cloud, so it's just basically setting up a virtual machine. There's some cost there, but frankly, it's not the type of cost that the board couldn't absorb. So given the extended time frame, I think the cost will be relatively nominal, and again, I anticipate at least saying that the board can absorb the costs.
Thank you. Clarifications needed? Additional question? Representative Lee.
Yeah, just wondering if it's just a technical thing or if you will need to hire contractors or more staff.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we don't anticipate hiring additional staff. I should state that in addition to modifying the application, we do think there is a limited training obligation here in terms of how to use the application, but the bill provides that the actual regulation of local elections remains with the counties and cities and school districts. So in that area, we don't anticipate additional staff. It's just providing some material to help them use the application.
Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I would just say, you know, last week we passed we passed Chair Freiberg's bill to redact addresses from like our filings, and you know, there was like a portion for local and state filings, but those are kind of like not really regulated right now, right? Like it depends on how your county runs these filings. So in Ramsey County, you know, the campaigns at the city and the county level, they just like literally upload their PDFs to the county website. And so, you know, it is my hope that something like this will help kind of streamline this process, especially, you know, as we look to redact those filings as well. So thanks.
I didn't think that needed a Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was the motion to send this to the general register? Okay, seeing nods. I'm just wondering if, since a fiscal note was requested this morning, I'm wondering if we should potentially wait until we've received that before sending it to the general register, or if it comes back more substantial than we expect, potentially send it to the Ways and Means.
My understanding is that the testifier is the head of the entity and is familiar with the budgets. I believe he just stated that it would be absorbed and that there were trivial, there might be some trivial costs, but you know, this is what, studying for, to see about the feasibility, and the only, you know, the expert on this is our testifier. And the expert's opinion is there would be no additional, it'd be absorbed and there'd be no additional cost. And so if there was a change to that, then that could be brought up, you know, at the end, because it'd have to be moved to Ways and Means from Rules, and we can recall that on the House floor and do that motion. I've heard that before, I believe. Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was getting some questions. Maybe you could, I think I might know what you were getting at, but maybe you could explain what you meant when you said it would go to Rules.
I'm sorry. Okay. Not Rules. It's, it would be General Registry, and then there's a committee before it hits the floor that would take it and put it on the calendar. But again, if there was a huge fiscal note, maybe they use a lot of gasoline to power something and prices are up, then we can always make a motion on the House floor to move it to Ways and Means to where they could address that. Representative McDonald.
Really quick, Mr. Chair, although I agree with the Chair Freiberg that it's good to have a fiscal note, I think on this one, because the testimony is probably not completely necessary, and I appreciate the fact that you recognize the importance of the fiscal note, and I must have to remind you, unfortunately, because in the sessions of 23-24, when the Democrats had the trifecta, there was bill after bill after bill that had little fiscal notes, even when it came to the floor, let alone a committee. And that was completely egregious, in my opinion. Not to bring up the past and bad things in the past, or good things, depending on your point of view. It's always good to have a fiscal note, but you guys did beautifully not having one in 23-24. So in this case, let's send it to the general register.
Well, I think we've heard, you know, comments from both sides about the, you know, a very small thing. Anything, did you, Chair Freiberg, have an additional comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, just, I can understand what you're saying. I understand what the director said about it. I do think Generally speaking, the Campaign Finance Board is one of the more agreeable state agencies when it comes to requesting fiscal notes. Just lest we rush into the vote here, I don't know. I think maybe just at least for this, for the moment, I'm going to request a roll call just because I just don't want there to be any uncertainty if we do. You know, I do think there's good things in this bill, but I guess I just have a little concern with, you know, based on what you said. Yes, we could vote on the floor to send it back, but that seems, you know, we do still have a couple weeks here. That seems like a lot of steps to take, you know, when we could just, you know, hang on to it, make sure, you know, maybe get a fiscal note, just confirm what the director said, and you know, rather than kind of rush it to the floor. So I'll leave it at that right there for the moment.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I'm a little bit confused in that if there was a dollar amount out of the budget, this we would be voting to move on to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Lee.
Yeah, I mean, what Chair Akam just said, I mean, we don't have a budget agreement, so I actually disagree. Like, we wouldn't vote it out to Ways. We would probably wait until there's a budget agreement before we do that.
Let me look at this bill. And I don't see any dot, dot, dots. So I don't think this shows any cost. The expenditure bills tend to have dot, dot, dots for the appropriation amount. So I am confused as to why there's reluctance. But we'll have the author speak. We'll do a roll call, and we'll see just who wants to, you know, move a very reasonable bill supported by the Campaign Finance Board, which is a nonpartisan entity, and quoted as being no external additional costs. So, you know, I assume that whoever's going to come and try to do a fiscal note is going to talk to him, and when he tells them they're going to absorb it, then it's $0. So, you know, then we can put it on whoever's chairing at that time for it's a $0 and move it along. But I guess if we'll find out if we have the votes to pass that, and you'll take a roll. No, we're going to take a roll because you've already commented on that.
Okay, I was going to offer to withdraw. Comment. I was going to offer to withdraw it if you were interested.
Well, you can withdraw it if you want. Yep, I will take that.
Well, now I'm changing my mind. No, just kidding. I can withdraw the roll call.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. No. Ayes have it, and the bill shall move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Quam.
Well, thank you. And
Betty.
It feels more like a Monday morning than a Monday afternoon. And our next author is moving to the table. And if you'd like to move your bill.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Quam. I would like to move HF 3721 before the committee and refer it to the general register.
Okay. I didn't see an amendment. No amendments to your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is very simple. Right now, colleges already have websites and provide information on voting. And what this does is just it's going to make it more consistent and more complete. Right now, if you go to the websites of different colleges, you will find many different versions of that information. So this will have the information on voting in Minnesota and registering to vote, and then also requesting how to request absentee ballots from other states if the student is living outside of Minnesota and they do choose to vote in their in their home state. I think there was a testifier.
Okay. The testifier, all right. Ms. Freeman, if you would introduce yourself and then your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Altendorf. Nicole Freeman from the Office of the Secretary of State. Wanted to just provide a few comments on House File 3721. So we believe, of course, information to college students on how they can vote in the state, whether it's Minnesota or wherever they're claiming residency, is really important. And wanted to recognize, you know, the legislature felt like that was important too as they updated these requirements in 2023 and 2024. Currently, most post-secondary institutions meet the requirement in Subdivision 1, which requires them to provide voter registration applications to their students. They do that by sending a dedicated voter registration email in both May and September. Included in that email, many are already including national voter registration information. They're including a resource like vote.gov, which then links folks directly to their state election official. So we believe the change in Subdivision 1 wouldn't have a large impact because a lot of folks are already doing that. However, we don't believe that the change on page 3 would be necessary, or at least this language would be needed. As you can see on lines 2.31 to 2.33, it's already required that post-secondary institutions provide, quote, resources to help students who are registered in another state to apply for absentee ballots in that state, and may include resources from state and local election officials from that state. So they're already required to provide resources. And I think we are concerned with the language on page 3 in that it's asking them to provide applications and asking a voter, a student vote coordinator, to have 49 states' applications on hand is impractical, I think. Those voter registration forms could change based on other states' actions, you know, with little notice, and the information. Really, the best practice would be to refer students back to their home state election administrator, which they're already required to do on their websites. So happy to support the change on Subdivision 1 and wouldn't support the change on page 3. So thank you.
Ms. Freeman, now you mentioned a link that would get them to their state's site. On that site, does that have the forms to fill out, Ms. Freeman?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, oftentimes those it depends, right? So many states in across the country, they have online voter registration or online absentee applications, and if they don't, yes, they would have those forms online typically, or would. There are some states where you have to go directly to your county or your city clerk to get that information, but all of that can sort of be drilled down through those websites.
So it would be nice, you know, maybe the Secretary of State's aware of what the other states are doing, so he's up to date on what's being done and can implement good things he sees somebody else bring up. But I would think that there would be someone that could easily get the total number of states that don't have that capability online, and that those would be the only ones of where there'd have to be additional activity, because it seems as if the ones that are already doing it to this link, that the my interpretation of what you said is most of them, you click that link, you can get to where you need to do stuff, you can do it there, and you know it's done. So I'd love to have everybody that's sending out these emails include that one little extra line, you know, share across the community of those colleges and have them include, you know, more fully include, so they've got that there. And I can ask the author about your thoughts on the discussion and testimony we just received.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and then thank you, Nicole. We do think that this is a very, very easy thing for the colleges to be doing, and it's going to be with almost little to no cost to them. As I said, they already do have a website, and this is just bringing some sort of consistency across. If you look at websites like the University of Minnesota, which was very vague, and then you look at the University of Minnesota Duluth, it did go into more description of how to vote in your home state. And so we just are asking for consistency, which seems to make sense as people are seeking that information. And this, as you mentioned, I mean, it's easy to do. There's national resources. This is not difficult. It's just providing consistency.
Thank you. And it does look as if Representative Lee's got a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So I guess a question for the author based on the conversation we just heard, because what I just heard is a little bit inconsistent with page 3, lines 3.3 to 3.5. Like, would sharing a website address be sufficient to, you know, furnishing a student with both a voter registration form and the absentee ballot form?
To the author.
Thank you, Chair Quorum, and thank you, Representative Lee. The application section could be as simple as just printing that out for the student.
Representative Lee.
Okay, yeah, because what I'm hearing is it's different, right? It's not just sending an email. It's like, you know, I think when I read this, it means that you're requiring universities to print out literally both the registration form and the absentee ballot form for each student.
To the author.
Chair Quam, Representative Lee, let me read that again. I would like to ask, I guess, nonpartisan if that's how they are interpreting it as well.
And who would, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, Representative Altendorf, these lines of the bill do require the post-secondary institution to provide the form, both the registration form and the absentee ballot form. It doesn't specify whether it could be through an electronic link to that form or whether it needs to be physically printed out by the institution. I think that would probably be up to the institution's discretion based on the way that this is written, but it does require the provision of a form in some format to students when they request it.
To the author.
Thank you, Chair Quorum. So my intent was, I believe what you said, is it's providing the link, right? And so that would be made available to them through the website.
Representative Coulter.
Oh,
I'm sorry, yeah. Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So, yeah, I mean, I guess if the intent doesn't seem to be lining up with, like, the language in the bill, I would, you know, recommend us, like, not move this and maybe, you know, lay it over and work on it to make sure that this language is aligned with what the author intends. You know, if it's merely sharing a website, like, we should be specific about that. And then, you know, I just direct folks to lines 2.31 and 2.33. There is already language that, you know, students should be given these resources. So, you know, that's just my concern because, right, like, if we're keeping the language in page 3, you know, as it is, my concern is, you know, you would need to probably hire someone to do the research, find the right forms, the voter registration form and the absentee ballot form. And, you know, the concern is our higher education staff administrators, like, this is not their job, right? Like, you're going to have to hire someone to do that to know for sure, like, these are the right forms. And I actually think that that's not the job of, that's not their job. Like, that's what the Secretary of State is supposed to do. And so I would be concerned about that, right, with this language as it is. And it seems like maybe, you know, that's not what you're intending.
To the author.
Thank you, Chair Quorum. at this point, again, I think this is very simple. We're asking for uniformity for the colleges to provide links. So the same information is given about how to register to vote if you do not live in the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
Representative Lee.
And then I guess my other question is, you know, we have a Minnesota state college system. You know, I'm curious if a fiscal note has been requested to see, you know, what this impact would be to our universities.
Chair Quam, there's not been a fiscal note asked or required at this time. Again, this is a very, very slight change, and it's asking for consistency of what the colleges are providing on their websites. There would not need to be a fiscal note on this. And again, it just, I don't know why, but this is about, I would say, good governance, about having consistency of what the colleges are doing. And I would hope that we would have support for this. It should be a very simple bill.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, excuse me, Representative Lee hit on a lot of the points that I was going to make. I mean, Representative Altendorf, with all due respect, if that is your intent, that is not the way the language reads. And as somebody who has spent a lot of time working on higher education policy, I can almost guarantee most every school would look at that and say, we are going to be required to print off voter registration forms, absentee ballot request forms for all of our students who live out of state. And just for a sense of scale, there are probably 10 to 12,000 students just at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities who live in other states. So this, I mean, this would be a pretty significant cost to, at the very least, our public colleges and universities in this state. And I do think, and if that's not the intent, then I think we should lay the bill over and we can get an amendment and fix that. If the intent is just to provide information, I do think it's covered currently in statute, but I think we really need to clarify this because I think that would be a pretty significant cost. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the author.
Thank you, Chair Quam and Representative Coulter. And again, this is not, it's not complicated, and it's for all of the colleges to have uniformity. So I do feel comfortable with moving forward with this.
Representative Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have anything substantively to add to the concerns the members on the DFL side have raised. I did want to mention, you know, before I make a specific request, I do want to note, like, I think in a tied House and a tied committee, it can be very challenging on voice votes to know where everybody lines up. So if I do happen to request a roll call, it's not an attempt to, like, make a gotcha vote or anything like that. I just want to make sure that we're accurately reflecting the will of the committee. So just with, you know, even when it can lead to some wackiness like it did on the last bill, that being said, I will request a roll call on this one. Just again, it's not intended as a gotcha or anything like that. I just want us not to be in a position where there's any ambiguity, seeing as we are tied.
And it is noted. A roll call has been requested. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to point out for those that are having some issue with it. I mean, from how I read it, it's and thanks, Gordon, for pointing that out. It's upon the student's request, right? So the language in 3.3 to 3.5, I mean, I don't know how a post-secondary institution would think that they have to print that out when it's upon the student's request.
I hear lots of page turning. Representative Lee.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if the author has a comment on that, but, you know, I would say if it is on the student's request, like, this is something that, you know, colleges have to forecast for, right, and say we need to have an elections expert on campus who can do this, right? Like, that's what the legislature has mandated. And so this is why, like, we do need a fiscal note for our state colleges or our public colleges.
Is Ms. Freeman still here? And my curiosity, Ms. Freeman, is, has the Secretary of State's office provided any assistance to the colleges in order to be able to do what they did, and letting them know about the .gov, you know, sites and et cetera. Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Yes, so the office does provide guidance related to national resources that are out there. I think that, again, I think our point was that the folks at the college shouldn't be the ones required to seek out the proper form or the proper method for the voter, that they could use those national resources to direct the voter to their local election administrator, whether that, again, that's at the state level or if they drill down further, but that then that voter is getting the information from the state where they reside as to how they need to, you know, do they need to update, what are those deadlines, and things like that. So wanting instead for the role of the campus vote coordinator and the website to be to provide people to the guidance of the source experts, the local election administrators, whether it's at the state or further down, rather than providing the actual forms as the bill requires.
So my understanding of the reply is that the election expert is at the Secretary of State's office. That's where the, you know, university would contact, and that it appears as if they assisted when the Edler law was passed to provide some of this guidance, and that's why some of the universities have these links. So it wouldn't be requiring, as the other law that passed isn't, a expert at the university. It plays off of the Secretary of State's office being the resource when there's questions, and as stated by the testifier, they provided some links, so it sounds as if the universities would be able to either follow that link and pass that on, or they could check back with the same people that they have checked back when they contact the Secretary of State's office about a additional polling location and the materials and the things needed to be able to do that, which I think that has passed into law fairly recently too. So there is a resource that is used to getting calls from universities, and also I think there are additional polling locations and other activities that were put in statute that has built this strong partnership between the universities and schools and the Secretary of State's office. So with that strong partnership, I don't think a on-site expert would be needed, because they've already got that relationship built. Representative Lee.
And that's precisely why, like, this bill is not necessary, right? Because this responsibility should lie in the office of the Secretary of State, right? You know, there's vote.gov and a bunch of websites already available. And, you know, if there are experts at the Secretary of State, and, you know, then, you know, folks can contact them. But this bill, as written, would add another responsibility to higher ed institutions to get it right when it is not their job.
I can check with the author. My understanding, when I was listening attentively to the author and to the testifier, that there is a discontinuity of the extent of material assistance that's being provided to the students, where I believe Ms. Freeman stated that a lot of, but not all, have the links. So when I was listening to the author was, the intent was to fill that gap and have, you know, everything covered. In other words, not all universities are putting that link and that information available, but I'll let the author speak for herself.
Chair Quam, I think Representative Davis had a...
Representative Davis.
Yeah, I don't think this is confusing at all. So colleges can, Ms. Freeman, colleges can provide the link on where to do this at, but then they can't click on the link themselves and hit print to print them off for the student. So 18-year-old college students we're expecting them to do that, but the staff just can't simply help them do that. That makes zero sense to me.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's been a lot of conversations about colleges. Representative Oltendorf, have you talked to anybody at Minn State or University of Minnesota System about how this would work or how, you know, we are making speculation. This is not the higher ed committee, but have you talked to anybody about this language?
To the author.
Chair Quam and Representative Greenman, I have not. And again, this is one of those examples, I would say, here at the Minnesota State Legislature where we are overcomplicating something that does not need to be this complicated. It really is not. The colleges already have, they already have websites, they already are providing the information, and this was just a means to make sure that we're providing the same information. You know, in some states, you know, it might be more advantageous for them to vote in their home state, and perhaps they didn't know that, right? If it's just leaning, this is the Minnesota registration application. So we want to make sure that they're seeing their own states as the option too, whether they choose. It doesn't change where they choose to vote. They absolutely can still register in the state of Minnesota, but it's just making sure they understand that they have the choice.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as somebody who does not do a lot of work in universities but has done much more minor provisions than this, I worked with the folks who are going to have to administer it, because if we don't actually talk to the people who are going to have to administer it, it oftentimes doesn't meet the intent of our bill. This goes to the general register. We have two more weeks of session, and I'd strongly encourage anybody, if we want this to work, we actually need to make sure that the bodies, in this case, Minn State and the University of Minnesota Systems, who are actually going to execute it, tell us technically how it'll work. And most of this committee hearing has been us all speculating on both sides of the aisle about how this works. Some folks have more experience than others, but there are actually people who do this, and it will impact. And so I strongly encourage us either to lay it over or going to have to vote against the bill, because it goes to the general register next, and we haven't even talked to the people who are going to administer it, and that's just bad policymaking. Thanks, Madam Mr. Chair.
And I don't want to, get into postmortem abuse of an equine, so please take the roll.
Chair Freiberg. No. Chair Quam.
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lee?
No.
Representative Acomb?
No.
Representative Coulter?
No.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gordon?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Roach?
Aye.
Representative Vernig.
No.
It being a 6-6 tie, the bill is laid over.
Chair Quam, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 3845 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Thank you. And would you like to describe your bill before we have the testifiers?
Certainly. Basically, this bill is fairly straightforward in that because we do have a large number of registrations that happen same time as a person is then casting the ballot, and there not being any opportunity to verify that there is aren't any issues with registration. This would say, just like 98% of the people that live in the United States live where they're not denied a ballot because they are granted a provisional ballot if there's any issue, and then they're given basically a week to take care of any questions that have arisen. And so this would improve the integrity of the election and ensure that no one is denied a ballot. I have had a election judge contact me and inform me that there have been people denied a ballot and have had to leave the polling location without being able to cast a ballot. And this would allow the state of Minnesota to actually abide by federal election law and not deny anyone the ability to cast a ballot.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Kwan. And with that, we'll move to the testifiers. Please go ahead and state your name and continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Altendorf and Chair Kwan, for bringing House File 3845. My name is Nicole Freeman. I'm the Government Relations Director at the Office of the Secretary of State. First, I just want to note that the office appreciates the many changes from other versions or past versions of provisional balloting that we've seen. However, we do still have concerns about the bill. Today, I'll focus on our most immediate concern, which would be the administrative consequences of changing election law in such a big way, so close to the 2026 elections. As you can see, the bill's effective date would be just a little over a month before the primary election. And with that, you know, comes just weeks of preparation for election administrators to get ready for that. While the bill does target a very small subset of Election Day registrants, it requires reworking really the entire system. So every election judge would need to be trained on how to administer provisional ballots in every polling location across the state. In addition, each of the 8 to 7 counties would need to have be prepared to administer the process both on election day as well as in the days afterwards. Again, back to sort of the timing challenges related to this, we're training county election administrators in just over a month in the middle of April. And so this major change, you know, wouldn't be included in that training. The legislation would also likely require changes to programming of the elections equipment, and it would require our office to set up a statewide tracking system for these provisional ballots. That tracking system doesn't currently exist. Finally, there's issues with the changes in canvas dates for both the county and the state canvassing timelines. It would lead to issues with the state of Minnesota conforming with the Electoral Count Reform Act in a presidential election year. So overall, the change would increase the cost and complexity of administering our elections just a month before implementation would be required. And for that, we ask the committee, or the office doesn't support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Chair Kwan, did you?
I guess I'm confused by changing the programming and election equipment. The ballots wouldn't be run through. And we're already capable with the election equipment to be able to run absentee ballots through at a different time. So I'm confused by that. The other confusion I have is that with the vast majority of the United States not denying anyone the ability to cast a ballot, and that's been around for decades, and that is federal law. So the confusion is how we can implement it. Well, all these other states have been able to implement it. They've got variations. There's been same day registration states that have had absentee ballots. So this is, we're the outlier in not having implemented it. And to think that this is so difficult that the people in Minnesota could not fix it. You're not reinventing the wheel. You've got, you know, about four dozen other wheels out there that you could copy. So it's long past time where Minnesota actually abided by federal election law with the vast majority of the country. So the other issue that does come up is the fact that we're averaging over 10,000 bad registrations a cycle. And that is off of the publicly available HAVA SSA site that is dictated in federal law and that Minnesota's been utilizing for decades. 2018, there were over almost 17,000 bad registrations. And that was around the time that we had the last audit of our election system. The 2020, that very next election, there were over 23,000 bad registrations. So election integrity ought to be a prime thing that this committee goes towards. Because I remember there being a Senate race, which was decided by a few hundred votes. I know that there have been multiple legislative races decided by, you didn't have to use all your fingers to count. So it's not trivial to have all these bad registrations. So I have no problem. In fact, I want everyone to be able to come into a polling place and having a ballot so they could vote. But the integrity, which is this component of integrity is, again, where 98% of the people live in the United States have this component of integrity and insurance of everybody gets a ballot. And that is the intent of this bill.
Thank you, Chair Quorum. And we'll move to member discussion. We have a list. First is Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kwong, for bringing this awesome bill. I love your bill. It adds a simple verification process without blocking votes or disenfranchising a voter who fills one out. It strengthens the integrity of our elections, which I am always a big thumbs up on. And I don't understand why the Secretary of State's office is always against us trying to do something with provisional ballot, because it also helps us align with HAVA's best practices. So thank you for that. 94% of our states have some type of provisional balloting. Why Minnesota is behind on this, this brings more integrity to our elections. This brings better security to our elections. And you know, I understand, you know, I've heard over and over the Secretary of State come in and say the crown jewel of our elections is same-day voter registration. When I had an elections supervisor tell me if there's going to be fraud happening, the most likely place it'll be happening in our elections is with same-day voter registration. That was an elections supervisor in the state of Minnesota telling me that, Mr. Chair. So they saw the writing on the wall very clearly. I think the crown jewel of Minnesota's election should be having provisional balloting for same-day voter registration. This is very common sense. Thank you, and I will be supporting your bill.
Thank you, Representative Davis, and we'll keep on moving. We have more. Representative Greenman, you're up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll note that this is, as I think Representative Davis was referring to, there is an evergreen provisional balloting conversation, and I appreciate the work that has been done. What I will say is actually Representative Quam makes the argument nicely about why we don't need this. We have had lots of close elections in the United States going back, I think you said 2006, to recently that have been tested both by courts and by public opinion and have held up when we think about elections integrity, when we think about election security, and when we think about voter access. And I think we have a long history of striking that balance in the way that both works for the public, works for voters, and works for our high voter turnout, which we all, in a nonpartisan and bipartisan way, brag about. What provisional ballot does, provisional balloting does, and for folks who didn't follow how we got here, provisional balloting was originally a response to what happened in Florida in a bunch of states where there was no fail-safe. If there was a registration error and you were not allowed to vote, you were turned away and couldn't cast a ballot. And if that was the system, then a maybe pile of ballots is better than nothing. But in Minnesota, since 1974, we've had same-day registration. So if you show up, you have an issue with your registration, you can same-day register. Vast majority of people don't do that. But that is our fail-safe. So when we think about that, striking that balance. My concern, particularly with this bill, and I think we've seen this before, is when I've seen provisional balloting bills in the past, they've had millions of dollars of fiscal notes that have to do with that changing, adding that maybe pile, adding the training, and the training and the setting up the administration is actually what prevents people from being disenfranchised. There are states where a third to a half of provisional ballots are thrown out, and that is, if we did this, we wouldn't want to be one of those states. So I am wondering, one, if there is a fiscal note on this bill, and if there isn't, why haven't we requested one?
Chair Quam.
I need to clarify some of the statements. They were slightly off in the fact that if half of the ballots aren't counted in other states, you neglected to understand that they could have been bad and fraudulent ballots. Minnesota actually, in this past year, has had multiple convictions of people that were registering multiple people across multiple counties of voter fraud, voter registration fraud. And that's when you get enough time to actually check and verify. And all the close races, you know, those close races, there have been far greater number of registrations determined bad in those elections than the difference in those races. You know, so if you have a race decided statewide by about 300 and some odd votes, and you have over 10,000 bad registrations as verified federally, then I think that calls into question that you didn't have more bad votes cast than the difference was. Looking at the analysis, the vast majority of the registrations are happening in that window when votes are being cast. You know, we go a month and a half and we have the primary just before that. Overlooking voter integrity is a huge thing, and the cost, I assume there's some cost to actually do your stuff on time. Yeah. And that means verifying before you actually count the ballot. And that's not happening. And that's not happening in the thousands. So it depends on your priority. If you really want to follow federal election law, because there have been same-day voting states that had provisional ballots. And you're saying, yeah, throwing, half of them are thrown out. There's cause to throw out those ballots.
Thank you.
The person doesn't have the actual documentation to verify that it's a good vote.
Sorry. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I would say is, actually, we can learn from other states. In most cases, the reason ballots get thrown out is because people don't go back, right? Because going to the polling place is good enough. But we actually have the verifications in place. You actually made the case for, again, our system working. I was in the Fraud Prevention Committee when we heard about the case you were talking about, which was in federal court. It was a situation where an issue was caught before anyone was added to the rolls, before anybody showed up or voted. And so, and then there was a prosecution, what you're talking about. Each of these cases, to me, is you are making the case is that we have actually created a system that detects that at the local level issues and handles them, and actually using those as examples of what we're not doing doesn't make any sense. And so I, one, don't think that this is necessary. I think introducing a maybe pile of votes has been problematic in other states. It'll be problematic here. But what I will say, and you didn't really answer my question, is if we were to do this, we would need to make sure to do it right in a way that we are doing the training and the administration at every city and every county elections administration, because we administer elections at the local level. Again, it's had fiscal notes in the past of millions of dollars. And so the idea of both not knowing, not having a fiscal note, sending this on without knowing what it costs, sending it on without actually having a plan for how all of our local jurisdictions are going to implement it, and then doing that a month before the primary, to me, is a recipe for both chaos and undermining the integrity of our system that is well trusted in Minnesota and has shown that it's effective, and with the high voter turnout that we have seen. If we don't have a fiscal note, members, we shouldn't vote for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and Chair Freiberg, I think you wanted. Did you want to request a?
Yeah, just wanted to make sure roll call was requested.
Okay, so Chair Freiberg requests a roll call, and Chair Kwan.
I guess I'm confused, because it was the feds that actually got those voter fraud convictions. If we had, and that was election cycles ago, and if there actually was the discovery in Minnesota of all this election registration fraud, then it should have been brought up years ago, and the AG should have gone for, you know, convictions, but it wasn't. It waited several years, and the feds had to discover it and bring it up and get the convictions. But the idea that there is no problem with, before you even check a registration, the ballot is cast. That's what happens. Because I've been a observer at elections before I came into this body, and you know, people come, register, and run it through the machine.
Thank you, Chair Kwan. Representative Roach, and then I think we're going to go to closing comments, unless someone else was on the, okay.
Thank you, Chair Altendorf. To be honest, I mean, this bill's just okay. I mean, it doesn't go far enough if you ask me. I mean, this is just a small step in the right direction. We're one of a handful of states that don't have provisional ballots. This just requires it if you can't provide a Social Security number or a driver's license on same-day registration. Minnesota's elections are a laughingstock. I mean, whether it's, they are, you can chuckle on the other side, but we're allowing us to stand on the behalf of up to eight people to come up and get a ballot and vote. I mean, whether it's that or, you know, ballot access for minor parties, it's kind of a laughingstock. So this is a step in the right direction for us to, you know, allow still people to have a ballot and allow them to vote, but just set the ballot off to the side so we can verify that those individuals that are getting a ballot are eligible to vote. As we've seen in testimonies before, there's nothing stopping illegal immigrants in this state from actually getting a ballot and voting, except for the Honor Society. And in that case, they weren't honorable when they got here because they came here illegally. So we're just supposed to take the fact that they're going to be honorable now. So, you know, again, I support this bill, but I think if it was me, I'd go even more.
Thank you, Representative Roach. Chair Kwan, closing comments, and then we'll go right to the roll call vote.
I think we've had robust discussion.
Roll call.
Chair Kwan.
Aye.
Chair Freiberg.
No.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lee?
No.
Representative Acomb?
No.
Representative Coulter?
No.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gordon?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Roach?
Aye.
Representative Vernig?
No.
With that, the vote is 6-6, and the vote does not prevail. We will lay this over. All right, and Chair Quam, if you want to move your next bill before the committee.
I move HF 3720 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Registry.
Thank you, Chair Quam. And to your bill?
A few years ago, there was a deletion of some items in regards to precinct caucuses. One of the two major parties then put that into their constitution because they felt it was important to, I'll mention the three. A voter must be eligible to vote in the next general election to participate in a caucus. A voter must have voted or affiliated with the party at the last state general election or intend to vote or affiliate with the party. So basically saying you're going to the right caucus. And the third is the whole caucus must determine the right of a person to participate in the caucus if a person's right to participate is challenged. Basically, there's the caucus system and there's the primary system. I like the caucus system because your neighbors and your community come together in the caucuses and you talk and discuss. I also love that high school students frequently come to observe and learn about the system. And at every caucus that I've convened or been part of, those high school students have been invited to have some discussion with the members. They don't get to vote if they're not going to be eligible to vote at the next election. But that's how you have people that, you know, young people become involved a little bit more than just a primary. So I will sit back and wait for the wonderful questions.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Representative Coulter?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam, for knowing that my questions would be wonderful. I will be brief since we are low on time. I was actually the author of these deletions 2 years ago. Caucuses are a party-run affair. They're organized, funded, and administered by political parties. Nothing that happens at precinct caucuses or at any conventions that occur as a result of them, none of that has any determinant on who can vote, who appears on the ballot, any of that. I was approached about that language because I just don't think state law is the place to be regulating who can participate in precinct caucuses and who can't. These are meetings that occur as a result of they are organized by a political party, not state elections. So I don't support the bill. I don't think it's necessary. That's all.
Thank you. And then Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to request a roll call.
A roll call has been requested.
Secondly, I did want to speak a little bit to this. I share Representative Coulter's concerns. And it's not just a matter of Chair Quam, I do appreciate you mentioning the fact that caucuses and primary elections are different. Precinct caucuses, as Representative Coulter alluded to, are a function of the major political parties. They're there to conduct the business of the major political parties and not the state. I mean, you wouldn't want the state trying to dictate who the chair of either the GOP or the DFL should be. But more than that, too, there's a real legal issue that led us to make this change a couple years ago also. Political parties are private organizations with constitutional rights to free association. And the Supreme Court has routinely held that government restrictions on who political parties can count as members violate those rights. So, I mean, I can cite a few different U.S. Supreme Court cases, Tashjian versus Republican Party of Connecticut, U versus San Francisco County Democratic Central Committee, California Democratic Party versus Jones. We were basically informed that the Minnesota law was on shaky footing for the same reason as the decision in those cases, and so we decided it was appropriate to revisit the law and make that change, and that's what we did. I think this would bring us back to a position of constitutional uncertainty, so I will not be supporting this bill.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Closing comments?
Frankly, Minnesota's got with their caucus system is somewhat unique with Iowa and a few others, and it does determine who's on certain ballots. So I disagree, and I wait for the outcome. And I renew my motion.
Thank you, and we'll move on to the roll call.
Chair Quam?
Yes.
Chair Freiberg?
No.
Vice Chair Alsendorf?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lee?
No.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Coulter?
No.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gordon?
Aye.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Roach?
Aye.
Representative Vernig?
No.
And with that, members, it's a tied vote, 6-6, and this bill will be laid over. And we are adjourned.